I would not upgrade a Windows 10 system to a Windows 11 system, but I would do a clean install of Windows 11. I am also anal. I will never basically install another operating system over a working operating system. Disks are cheap enough where you can buy another hard drive and do the install on that. And this way, should something horrible happen, it's a matter of exchanging hard drives rather than reconstructing your old system.
Okay, I understand that entirely. I have a nephew who wipes his computer at regular intervals and reinstalls everything from scratch. He does not have a lot of non-cloud-based information or configurations in software or a lot of installed software. I have so much nonsense installed and configured and fidgeted and played with that the last time I had to reinstall everything from scratch, it took me the better part of 3 straight days. I just don't like doing that. So, you know, I cross my fingers and my toes. I do a backup of everything, and I install. And occasionally, I have forgotten bits. Some of the updates were not really as close to ready for prime time as Microsoft would want you to. So I rolled them back to the previous version and gave it a 4 to 6 month holiday and then tried again, living dangerously. So, you know, your mileage might vary. If you don't have a lot of non-cloud-based data and configuration files and lots of install programs, that it certainly is the safest approach to start from scratch.
Oh, yes. My policy has always been to start from scratch. And also, if I've got anything that does not come on a TV or a DVD, I've got a special disk location, which I copy them to. So essentially, I've got all of the software to reconstruct my system somewhere on a hard drive, rather than having to go to a manufacturer whose website might be down or might be out of business or whatever. So I think I've got it covered, but you know, belt and suspenders and a spare pair of pants.
Ah, yes, indeed. The only problem I have with that philosophy is there are so many software companies that push so many updates that if you blink, it's an old version of the software. So once in a while, I start up software that I haven't used in a couple of months, and I check out the inevitable, hopefully, is this the latest version? And so I freshen up my list, and I do have a special subdirectory in a secondary hard drive that's titled something like Archive of All the Software for This Computer, and I try to keep it current with the latest version and a copy of the configuration file. One of the many problems that I can't get over with Microsoft is I would love for them to have a single place where the configurations for everything are. The problem is that sometimes the configurations are in the directory in program. Sometimes it's program X16 bit or something. Sometimes it's program data. Sometimes it's app data roaming. Sometimes it's app data local. Sometimes it's the registry. And there's probably other places where they hide the configuration files. So it's a mess trying to collect all the configuration files so that you can just cleanly transfer them to a new drive. So that's one of my basic annoyances with Microsoft in general, They change their mind every 6 months of where the configuration should go, and programmers have given up at this point to just put it wherever they want.
A22R1.
Okay. Person in there? Basically the stuff I write, I still use CNI file and possibly some JSON file. So I believe there was someone else in there giving the call.
Yes, David, do you want to join us here?
You know, with Apple Macintosh computers, at this thing called Time Machine. Do you know about Time Machine?
Yes, I know about Time Machine. As I mentioned, I have a separate backup facility. I back up every night, and so I basically can roll things back if I wanted to. It's not quite as nice as I'm told Time Machine is, but it suffices.
QSO. Yeah, thank you. I just wanted to put it out there.
Yeah, it's a very important thing to have, to kind of reverse stuff, at one point they had restore points to Microsoft and then did away with them and then brought them back quietly, so they don't sort of work too well, and who knows. I think one of the important things for complicated things like computers is the ability to kind of incrementally record the states of the machine. And if you notice something degrading, but not severely, and it just continues for 2 weeks, it's nice to go back to your files where it was 3 weeks ago, and you roll them right back to 3 weeks, and you're back where you need to be. I also know where new files are. So if I have data files in that directory, in that partition that I know are going to be swept away, I move them to another drive where they won't be swept away. But you have to keep in mind, where those files might be. Like I record an audio copy of the technical net about, every so often Mike from amateurradio.tv asks if I have a copy because his didn't work. So it's important that I not roll things back and basically delete my copies of these technical maps. And there's a few other things.
QSO. I guess when you take an application or a file from a backup, either another hard disk or some other place, there is a risk that the file can become corrupted. That's why, I do a clean install, and I install each application one at a time, download it, and install it, and get access to it. Go ahead.
Well, most well-written backup and restore software will validate copies to ensure that it's not a corrupted copy. I was able to get that across to this stupid piece of software, it took about 3.5 hours, but it restored it in pristine condition to the way it was about 2 weeks ago, and knock on wood, it's been working beautiful ever since. So the problem was that it doesn't seem to like things connected to USB ports or SD card ports or a whole bunch of different ports. It kind of likes to go from a hard drive inside the computer to another hard drive inside the computer or a solid state drive, which is a great limitation. I didn't experiment with a network attached storage, although I have those. I don't back up to network attached storage. I like to back up to local external hard drives, so that worst comes to worst, I can unplug them and take them to another room and download them and do things with them. But for some odd reason, the Achronix that I was using was very fidgety for all these things. Hopefully, my new R drive image software will be far less fidgety.
QSO, QSO. I have to say, my 2012 Macintosh computer, it's both 32-bit and also 64-bit. When I first got it, you know, I was operating 32-bit. When I upgraded to the operating system that required 64-bit, all the programs that were not compatible, you had like a symbol on them, and you knew you would just throw them away because they wouldn't work anymore.
Well, I mean, that's always the issue of legacy versus state-of-the-art. If you're, and Apple has been consistently non-legacy. They'll occasionally kind of build the kludges, but their attitude is they don't want to cut any corners. They don't want to cheapen the experience for the newest, shiniest thing. Whereas Windows has tended more towards legacy capability. There's even a window that comes up that you could set the compatibility for a program with different versions of Windows in case it doesn't really like 11 very well. So there's a case to be made for both situations. If you want to squeeze the most capability, you don't backfill for legacy because that generally bloats your code and causes other problems. But if you want to use old programs, then legacy is very useful. Everyone has a couple of programs that they found that the developer has stopped developing it, and it ends. So they're not going to get an update, so it either runs or they have to throw it away. And I have more than a few of those programs. I think a lot of people out there do as well.
Yes, sir. And the difference between the Intel Mac and the M1 and M2 Mac require different program, some kind of programming language. And I guess the idea is that for M1 and M2 Mac, the speed, the clock speed, the quality of processing, etc., is related directly to this Apple-made chip and the software that works with it.
Well, AC2GS, by the way, that's sort of the nature of just about all computing. The M1 and M2 chips have different architectures than the Intel, so the same assembly code would not work on M1, M2. So you either need a translation layer, which slows things down, or you need to recompile it for the architecture of the M1, M2, which usually gives better performance than the Intel, all things being equal. In the future, no doubt there will be M3, M4, M5, M6, etc. It's Apple doing what Apple does. It likes to design things in-house and improve them and promote them. And I wish them well. This is not the first time or the second time. They started with the Motorola 6800, then went to the Intel, and now the M1 and M2 series.
QSM. And, you know, I was looking very carefully for information regarding my old 2012 computer and TLS 1.2.
Did you find anything?
Well, the information I got was that my old computer is compatible with TLS 1.2. Old Mac computers, many of them are compatible with TLS 1.2. Maybe my Windows 10 computer is not, because, you know, it doesn't have the system requirements for that.
Well, you know, I mean, there's different They're different hardware. They're not identical, and they probably have different transport layer security systems. There's been a whole bunch of them. 1.0 and 1.1 and 1.2. I think 1.2 is the latest and greatest, so they're not that quickly moving up on them. There are other protocols that that change every hour and a half. Wi-Fi is, I think, a year and a half ago there was 6. Then there was 6E, which is, I guess, for enhanced. And now, soon, we're going to be presented with Wi-Fi 7 protocol. So that's going to be fun.
QSL. My website provider switched to TLS 1.2. And I guess, you know, whatever web material that I have there with this particular company, you know, is, how to say, secure with TLS 1.2. And it works fine on my computer. I was reading a couple things, you know, would an old Mac computer be compatible with TLS 1.2? You know, somebody was trying to tell me, maybe he was trying to sell me, PC computers that maybe Windows 11, or he said, well, Windows 12 comes out, that's when TLS 1.2 will take hold, and the Windows 10 computers will no longer be compatible. That's what he said.
Oh, okay. Well, now we have TLS 1.3 for people keeping score.
WB2KW6?
Yes, yes.
Okay, I mean, TLS is simply the way of protecting it as it goes over the wire. I'm not sure I understand why David said any of his content was or was not compatible with it. I'm confused.
Well, this is what somebody told me. I think he was a shopkeeper for computer PC electronics, and maybe it has nothing to do with the system requirements and what the computer can do.
Okay, that is extremely possible. Or he basically, if he was the guy at the website, he basically may have wanted to standardize all of the systems on transport level layer security. Or he's running you in a VM or as a Docker package and wants it all of the systems to be the same. Not sure. Anyhow, back to you, QGS, WB2KW.
Okay, thank you very much, Ken. Let me just make sure I have the repeater. Okay, for people who don't speak computer, VM is a virtual machine, and Docker is a type of virtual machine that runs on servers, and you can then plug in modules and have different programs that work in a virtual machine that's a little bit higher security than being directly connected to the hardware and such. I don't know, David. Probably they were upgrading to a more secure certificate system, and if your computer can't deal with the certificates and decode them, that's a major problem. I don't know. Anyway, David, thank you so much for participating tonight. It's 10:23, and it's time really for the SpaceNet report. So I thank you for participating, and I thank everyone who participated tonight. You guys that make or break these technical mess. You don't want to hear me going on and on and on. So thanks a lot, and I'll be back a little bit later on. But right now it's time for the SpaceNet report with Paul WS2N. Thanks, Roy. AC2GSWS2N for the SpaceNet report for the TechNet. And, don't have all that much, but a couple of interesting things in the last week. One of the main things was on all news stations is the Artemis 2 crew has been picked by NASA. Of course, Artemis 1 was that just went up for a 25-day flight, but unmanned, and it turned out to be very successful. They got a lot of information back to make them more comfortable with actually sending a crew up. So, you know, many news stations, TV, I mean, this is all over. At the new crew information and what they're about to do, which is essentially go out to the moon, not land on the moon, but and come back. They're going to reserve that for Artemis 3. We drop it. So you have the commander was chosen, Reed Weissman, Victor Glover, and Jeremy Hansen from Canada, and Christina Cook. Now, of course, what the news don't tell you is that three of the four are amateur radio operators. They all have their ham licenses. Commander Reed Weissman is KF5LKT. Victor Glover is KI5BKC. And then you have two mission specialists. One is a fellow from Canada, Jeremy Hansen, also KF5LKU. And Christina Cook, who does not have a ham license. She was going to get it. She went up in 2019 to the International Space Station. And she had plans of getting it. And you'll notice most of the calls are five calls. Because they train down in Texas. But what happened is they pushed her up 6 months earlier. And she put that on hold. Wound up going up to the space station, and then there was some changes that were made in the schedule, and they decided to leave Christina up there instead of 6 months, but a whole year. Anyway, she came back. Still hasn't gotten her ham ticket. I wouldn't be surprised if she gets it between now and then. Although I don't think they're going to need it. I'm not hearing about any two-meter operation that will be taking place on the Artemis 2 mission. But I can see that in the future. Not so much on the Orion spacecraft, which they'll be flying in. But eventually they plan on having another space station in orbit around the moon. It will be called Gateway. And already I know AMSAT is, they're already getting ready. The ham's involved with the International Space Station, the ARRI system, the amateur radio on the International Space Station group, could probably do the same thing. They have plans of doing the same thing on Gateway. So somewhere down the road, each flight will be roughly a year apart from one another. In the beginning, it will be a little longer than that. This flight won't take place until probably the end of 2024. And then the actual landing flight, they say another year later. Well, I have my doubts about that. They're still pretty far behind with developing a lander to get you from the Orion spacecraft down to the moon. Orion is an orbital vehicle that was going around the moon. They need a human landing spacecraft to go from Orion in orbit around the moon down to the surface and then back up again. That's pretty much a little further behind in development, what I think. They plan on originally using a Starship and eventually another lander being developed by Blue Origin, for instance. It's one of the companies that are involved. But hopefully someday in the future we'll be able to get a deep space QSL pod from I guess Gateway, and years after that, after you have, you know, maybe a permanent base on the moon, which, you know, is one of the goals of NASA. I could see it one day having a, you know, 2-meter transmission from the moon, or you know, maybe one of the other bands. Definitely digital will probably be one of them, you know, FD8 or something. But we'll see. I always said, you know, years ago, that would be great to get a QSL card from the moon. I guess the card itself might be difficult, but, you know, logbook of the world might be possible. Any comments? WSQI. Okay, sticking with Artemis. The Artemis 2 mission, like I said, will be the tail end of next year. They won't be going into a real orbit of the moon and staying there, you know, like they did with Apollo 8. Apollo 8 did 10 orbits of the moon and came back. Apollo 8 was that was the first time that humans left Earth and went into another gravitational field besides the Earth, went around the moon. This one's going to be a little different. Again, then going to land would be similar to Apollo 8. Of course, you'll have 4 people instead of 3 people. And what they'll do is leave on the Space Launch System with 8.8 million pounds of thrust. It'll be the first time that people have put on that rocket. Not the first time the rocket went up. The first time it went up was recently with Artemis 1. But once they leave Earth, they'll be in a pretty high first orbit, around 1,200 miles above the surface of the Earth. Normally you're 250 miles, let's say you're just going to the International Space Station. The space station is around 250 miles, circular orbit around the Earth. This will be around 1,800 miles for the actual first orbit of two. They'll check things out, make sure everything's okay. The idea of this whole mission is really to check out the environmental control systems on the Artemis. Once that first orbit and a half is confirmed, if there's a problem, they're able to come right back to Earth and land in the Pacific Ocean for recovery. But if all is okay, they plan on reigniting the upper stage again. And the interim cryogenic propulsion stage, the upper stage. So you have the initial launch from the launch complex 39B. You'll have, you know, your 4 liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen engines ignite. Each one is 500,000 pounds of thrust. So you add those together to the solid boosters. Each one of those is 3.3 million pounds of thrust. So you collectively, you'll have an 8.8 million pounds of thrust going uphill. 2 solid boosters will separate, and then around 8 minutes after flight, the core stage will separate with those 4 liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen engines. They'll separate the stack. And then your interim cryogenic propulsion stage, also liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen, will take over, and that will be reignited a couple times. The final time will be, the first time will be to get them into the initial orbit of 1,200 miles, and then they're going to ignite it again and go all the way out to around 43,000 miles, roughly twice the distance of where the geosynchronous satellites are. So that one long orbit will take them roughly 24 hours to make one complete orbit around the Earth at that distance. So that will give them plenty of time to check things out for the crew. Again, if all is okay, they'll reignite the same stage, the liquid hydrogen, the oxygen stage. That will reignite, put them on TLI, which is translunar injection to the moon. That stage will eventually separate, and that will leave them with just the Orion crew in the Orion spacecraft, along with the European Space Agency service module and its engine. So, I mean, they'll be on the way to the moon at that point. And their goal is to go to a figure eight configuration. In other words, go around the front end of the moon, circle around, and then come back again. If they were going to go into orbit, they would use that service module on tension on the on the Orion setup, Orion Class service module, ignite that, and I'll put a constant orbit around the moon. They don't plan on using that. They'll come around the front of the moon and go out around 4,000 or 5,000 miles away from the surface of the moon, which is actually a couple thousand miles further than any of the Apollo astronauts actually were in their missions. And then they'll come back around the opposite side of the moon and start heading home. The whole trip from Launch Complex 39C to the Pacific Ocean when they come back will be about 10 days. They'll come back, and it's a similar setup to what they did with Artemis 1. Come back 25,000 miles per hour. Each year will heat up to around 5,000 degrees Fahrenheit. The drogue chutes will eventually come out when it slows down enough. In turn, will pull out a set of pilot chutes, and the pilot chutes in turn will pull out three big main parachutes and land in the ocean. So, got a year and a half before this all happens. I thought I'd bring that up. That's what the crew will be doing. That's what they've been chosen to do. And I'm sure they're all thrilled about it. Including the one guy from Canada. He never flew before. Yep, the other three have been up for long duration missions on the International Space Station. But not him. He's going to be brand new. And they made a deal with NASA have Canadian on the first mission. And eventually you're going to have people from European Space Agency on a regular basis. This is basically an international deal. They're all putting money into it. European Space Agency is constructing service modules. Canada is really big time with the Canadian arm. The Canadian arm won for all the shuttle missions. And Canada arm 2 for the International Space Station is still up there. Still doing fine work on the space station. And this one's going to be called Canada arm 3. That will be attached to the Gateway space station, which will be in orbit around the moon. So many countries contributing, and it should be pretty exciting. As long as flight goes well, they don't have any more delays. They'll have roughly 1 year, 1 year apart for every space launch mission. That'll be scheduled to be going up. So, any questions, comments, WSLM. Okay, one other astronaut I wanted to mention is the next commander on Crew 7. That would be going to the International Space Station. And that would be Jasmine Warbell. She comes out of Baldwin, New York. She went to Baldwin Senior High School. So that's, to me, that's very noteworthy. And she's going to be the commander on Crew 7 up to the International Space Station. And she's got three other astronauts that have been picked that will be going on that flight as well. And talking about ham radio, Jasmine does have her call letters, KI5WSL. So that one, I'm sure we'll hear from on the International Space Station. They have the, there's actually two ham radio systems, two shacks on the space station, one the Russians have, and then one of their modules, and then we have the Ares 25-wide system. It's Kenwood rig, and it's located in the Columbus module. That'll be good. I don't have any call letters for the other three that are going up. One fellow's from Japan, the other one is from Russia, and the other one is from the European Space Agency, Denmark. Any comments? WSUS. Yeah. The first Starship is plan on actually launching within a week or two. And they're actually right now predicting April 17th. They have a window between April 17th and the 21st. And they're predicting that date, although, they don't confirm it. There's always some last-minute changes. One group says that they have the approval from the from our government to do this. They've been waiting for that. But technically, they say they're ready to go. So hopefully Elon Musk gets his Starship off the ground. And, talk about making the news. That will definitely make the news. This is the one he's been developing to eventually go to Mars. But he'll be happy to get this thing off the launch pad in Boca Chica, Texas. And he's not even going to do one hole of orbit. Right now it's planned on doing maybe three quarters of an orbit going all the way out to north of Hawaii. And it should deorbit at that point and then crash into the Pacific Ocean. But it will launch from Texas with 17 million pounds of thrust. Compare that to the 8.8 million pounds of thrust that the Artemis space launch system used to get Artemis 1 off the ground, and we'll eventually do that with Artemis 2 and so forth after that. This one, it's not the same, it's a completely different animal. The Artemis missions are expendable units. The first stage falls away and burns up over the Atlantic. The second stage the second stage continues on, winds up going into a helio
concentric orbit around the sun. Starship is supposed to be fully reusable. The first stage, called the Super Heavy booster, is running 33 Raptor engines, each one around 500,000 pounds thrust, or thereabouts. Running liquid methane, liquid hydrogen, compare that, liquid methane and liquid oxygen, compare that to the liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen for the SLS system. Completely different animals. Now that booster, long-term plans are to eventually deorbit that, have a boost back to it, and eventually have it come back and land where it took off from, exactly where it took off from the launch pad that it actually launched from. It lands on coming straight down vertically. You've got these big arms sticking out of the launch complex. They call them chopsticks. They're going to grab this thing and catch it as it comes down. That's their long-term plan. And then they'd be able to put it back on the launch mount, refuel it, and launch again. You know, his long-term goal is to make this reusable like an airplane. Now, Starship is the second stage. That's the top part. That's 220 feet long. You know, that's as long as the Falcon 9 rocket is today, the whole rocket. That will go into orbit, orbit the Earth, and then eventually deorbit, and that one will come flying through the atmosphere. They call it a belly flop. You know, kind of slow itself down aerodynamically. No parachute. This thing is eventually going to come through the atmosphere and getting slow enough to turn vertically, tail down. They plan on reigniting three of the six engines that are on board to slow them down to the point where they could actually land vertically. Again, where they took off from, in this case, Boca Chica, Texas. That's the long-term plan. But for now, he's going to be happy to get off the launch pad without blowing anything up. He's got all kinds of refueling tanks and all kinds of infrastructure that he's built down there in Texas. He gets off the launch pad. And over the Gulf of Mexico, he's going to be happy. That booster will eventually start to deorbit, and instead of coming back to Texas, they plan on just crashing that into the Gulf of Mexico for the first flight. And that will put the Starship on its way kind of into an orbital flight. He's actually talking about maybe actually putting that vehicle into orbit. But right now the plan is to go around the Earth almost once, deorbit and crash into the Pacific Ocean north of Hawaii. We'll see if this all works out. We've got a long way to go. NASA's got a contract with SpaceX to actually utilize one of these Starship vehicles to actually develop one to specifically go to the moon. And when he does that, eventually you won't have to worry about landing legs or anything like that, because the only landing legs they'll need is one that will actually land on the moon. He won't need wings or anything to guide it through an atmosphere like the other one has. So it'll look different. A little different than the original Starship, but it'll be a Starship. The goal is to put one of these things into orbit around the moon and leave it there. Now, after Artemis 2 goes up, goes around the moon, comes back safely and lands in the Pacific Ocean, a year or so later they plan on launching Artemis 3. present plans are for Artemis 3 to actually land on the moon. The goal would be to put Artemis 3 into orbit around the moon. Now, there's no gateway space station built yet, so there's nothing orbiting the moon. Artemis 3, the full Orion, will actually be in orbit around the moon, and it's supposed to eventually dock with the Starship that SpaceX has put into orbit around the moon. It's going to dock with that vehicle. The crew is supposed to transfer into Starship. Starship that's supposed to deorbit the moon and land. Their plan for landing near the south pole of the moon, again, vertically. Once it lands vertically, crew could get out. By the way, they plan on sending just two people down on the first mission. The other two will remain in orbit in Orion around the moon. And then the crew will exit Starship, do their EVA on the, their spacewalk along the surface of the moon, return to Starship, ignite the engines again. That vehicle has six Raptor engines attached to it. It will launch, ignite three of them to put it into orbit around the moon, dock with the Orion spacecraft, leave Starship, I guess, in orbit around the moon. I heard them talking about maybe eventually deorbiting that thing, or crashing it into the moon, or sending it out into heliocentric space, and, orbiting around the sun. The crew would come back on Orion, and similar to Artemis 2, they'll come through the atmosphere, 25,000 miles an hour, land back in the Pacific Ocean, and then that will be the end of Artemis 3. Long-term goals after that is to start building the Gateway space station in orbit around the moon. They plan on upgrading that second stage, the interim cryogenic propulsion stage that they're using now. That will be upgraded. Right now it has one big honking engine sticking out of the back. The upgraded one will have four engines out of the back, so collectively it will be able to bring out a lot more mass to the International Space Station, including parts of the Gateway Space Station. Construct that. Once that's built, then they could have a regular transition. As the years go by, again, every flight will launch from Earth, dock with the Gateway, and then eventually take the Starship back down to the moon and back. And NASA, in its wisdom, originally said, okay, we're only going to have one contractor, it's going to be SpaceX for the human launch system, the HLS system, ferrying people from the lunar orbit back down to the moon and back. They finally did what I was hoping that they would do in the first place. It took me about a little over a year to do it. Choose another contract. NASA has always been about redundancy. Two of everything, or two or more, We had half a dozen survey vehicles land on the moon before we actually went to the moon. We had many Ranger flights actually going to the moon and crashing into the moon, taking pictures right up to the last second. We didn't have one, we had more, because some of them failed. Same with the lunar orbiters that we had going around the moon before we went to the moon to take pictures. Multiple units. Pioneer spacecraft that went to the outer planet, Pioneer 10, Pioneer 11. They're still flying out of the solar system. Not working anymore, but in case one failed, we had a plan B. same with Voyager. We have Voyager 1, Voyager 2, both still functioning after since 1977. And for some reason, they got the idea that, well, we're just going to pick one HLS, Human Landing System, and that was going to be the Starship thing from SpaceX. I'm glad they changed. They plan on having another vehicle. It's going to be different than Starship. I mean, it's more or less like what we have with the LEM, except really on steroids. Again, you'll have a vehicle in orbit around the moon with Gateway. That vehicle will go down. It'll have its descent stage. It'll land on the moon, and then their ascent stage will use that platform of the descent stage as a launch platform to launch back up to a lunar orbit. I favor that system. It's reliable. We've done it before. So hopefully one of these work out. But at least you have a plan B. If one thing doesn't work, the other won't work. Look at the International Space Station now with problems with the Russians. Not only that, we had problems with the space shuttle when the Columbia spacecraft parked up in the atmosphere coming back. We had a delay, a year and a half, almost 2 years without flight to the space station. We were still sending crews up on the Soyuz vehicles, through the Russians. Now as time has gone by, decades are flying by, and now the Russians have all kinds of problems. Leaks in two of their vehicles, their cooling systems. They couldn't send a crew back recently. Crew had gone up, it was supposed to come back 6 months later in that same vehicle. So his 22 was leaking, so that's it, they didn't use that. Since then, they had to send this other one up, and they have deorbited the other one. And that eventually went back to Kazakhstan, and without a crew. Now this other crew, they're up there for 6 months. They're stuck there for another 6 months. They won't be coming back until September. But we have the Dragon spacecraft, which is taking people up on a regular basis, including Russians, which is very good. And there's another system, the Starliner, being built by Boeing that will be used for, commuting back and forth to the space station. You need these things. You need a plan. You need a plan B. You need plan C as well. Any comments? This is WS2N. I thought I heard somebody. Just one other topic that's running out of time is there's a flight from rocket launch from Israel. They use the Shavit 2 rocket when they launch from Israel, actually from the Israel, from their soil, and they put one of their, probably a military satellite. It's called the Olflex satellite system. The idea is to put a couple of these military satellites up there for Israel. Some of them have high quality
time complete
pictures, just like this one is. SAR system, synthetic aperture radar system, so they can look down on Earth. It doesn't matter if it's day, night, cloudy. They can see right through with their radar. course, not very good resolution with it. But that got off the ground successfully. By the way, the Oakland thing that means horizon and, you know, the rocket itself that they use on a regular basis when they launch. The Chevette, which is means comet in Hebrew. Probably have the pronunciation wrong, but anyway, that's what they've been using. I bring this up. I mean, there's so many launches worldwide. Why bring this one up? Because this one launches retrograde, backwards. All the launches that go up, either Russia, United States, China, either launch in one or two directions, either mostly to the east. Actually, if you go to the east, you can have more payload because you get the push of the Earth going in the right direction. Or they go into polar orbit. Polar orbit is very good for surveillance, climate satellites. They want to take pictures. Same spot on the Earth day after day. If the vegetation is changing or something, or the ice. Well, the Chevette is a rocket that launches west instead of going east. And why do they do that? They'd rather go over the Mediterranean Sea, because if something goes wrong with their rocket, it'll ditch in the Mediterranean. Go the other way, they can be over Jordan or someplace. They don't want to do that. So they always launch to the west. Interesting. And I'll bring that up to years ago, one of their rockets, they said a piece of their rocket, which is a little pink black, hit one of the space shuttles that were in orbit. And put a little thing in the window. Every time the space shuttles came back to Earth, they would use magnifying glass, sometimes microscopes, to look at the windows on a shuttle. Usually the forward-facing windows was always the direction of flight for the shuttle, although most of the time they were always flying upside down. But they were able to make a test of this little teeny tiny plate, little molecules that were left, and they figured out that it was a paint, and they analyzed it through a spectrometer or whatever it is to determine the exact paint, and they figured out it came from one of these Israeli satellites. So this little gold flake. Then they could actually figure out that 17,500 miles an hour that the spacecraft is going north, that shuttle is traveling, going east. Hit this little flick of paint of another, actually which was going in the westerly direction. Again, it's 17,000 miles an hour. So, over 30,000 mile an hour impact with this little flake and created this little thing, visible thing in the window. It happens a lot on the shuttle missions. They said that even the first 50 flights, they had almost 200 little teeny tiny things from something flying in space. It's quite common. Windows on the shuttle had an outer pane, an outer thermal pane in a glass as well. And that outer thermal glass was always being infected. And many, many times it was actually changed out. So it got expensive. Things worth like tens of thousands of dollars just for to replace one glass. But, interesting, what some of these rocket companies have to do. At the time, let me close down. Well, we'll continue on with the SpaceNet report next week. For now, they're happy to pass over to everybody. We're going to turn it over to Roy. We'll be on tomorrow night on the club info net, and as well as the Flopper Chopper.